mine? Steph nods as she attempts to extract crushed garbanzo beans from Morgan's hair. That's really late. I mean, not for us, but, you know, for Morgan. She doesn't sleep well with the sitter, or God, we'd be all over that place. Steph does a grinding little dance in her chair. It would be off the hook.
Off the hook, he agrees. Causing some trouble is what we'd be doing.
Areola, I say, grinning. Amazing. My phone chimes on the seat next to me as I make a left onto Santa Monica Boulevard. I ignore it, letting another Monday morning commuter in front of me and waiting for the light to turn green so we can all move for another 12 feet before it changes again. It will never stop bewildering me that a 4.5-mile trip takes almost an hour. I'm just about to reach for the dial on the radio when the phone chimes again, and again, and again. I glance over at it, the screen face down on the seat, and mentally calculate the rest of my drive. In California, it's illegal to use a cell phone while driving, so it's against the law to read or reply to any text messages. I'm about to tell myself I can wait when it goes off again. And again. When the light turns red, I slip my phone onto my lap and unlock the screen to reveal a slew of missed calls and messages from Becca. My passcode isn't working and I can't get in the building. Security says he can't let me in. Okay, Tara and Kyle can't get in either. What's going on? I can't get into my email. Carter, 911, emergency, fire, whatever. Call me now.
I dial, listening to the phone ring through my Bluetooth.
Carter.
Hey,
I accelerate, moving through the intersection. My heart is doing a weird dance in my chest. What's going on?
No idea.
Someone says something in the background, and Becca gives a quiet, okay.
Louder, she says to me, check your email. We have a meeting at a building in West Hollywood. I'll see you there.
And then she's gone. Bewildered, at the next red light, I open my email program and find a 2-line company-wide memo from CTM containing an address and instructions to be there by 9:30. Beyond that, nothing. Instead of heading straight, I turn right onto La Cienega. Parked in an underground lot, I emerge and stare up at the glass and steel building. It looks like any other sleek, new office structure. No identifying names or logos mark the front courtyard. The only thing I can imagine is that we're moving offices, or that something horrible has happened to our own building, but I've heard nothing on the news. And Becca, calm, collected, and immediately responsive 99% of the time, hasn't answered my follow-up call. I'm hit in the face with a blast of refrigerated air as soon as I step inside, and combined with the adrenaline pulsing through my veins, it awakens something instinctively New Yorker in me. It's settling, oddly. Turning down a marble hall, I check my phone a final time before slipping it into my pocket. A circular reception area is just ahead, topped by a set of large screens with the word Price and Dickel, and the logos and movie posters of some of the actors they represent, moving in and out of focus. My pulse trills in my throat. P&D recently moved. Is this where they're located? Off to the side is a smaller temporary table with a paper sign that reads CTM sign-in taped to the top, a beautiful blonde sitting behind it, and two uniformed security guards hovering nearby. Are we moving offices into the same building as P&D? The whole scene is odd enough to make me slow my steps. A red flare has just been shot up into the sky. Warily, I approach the table and catch the attention of the blonde wearing a headset. Through my nerves, I attempt my best smile.
Hi, this is gonna sound crazy, but...
She's all business. You're with CTM? I nod. She looks down her list. Name?
Aaron, I say, giving her my last name, then quickly clarifying. Carter, Aaron.
She hums, flipping through a few pages.
Here we are, Aaron Carter.
She hands me a clipboard with several pieces of paper trapped there. Did you know you have the same name as a Backstreet Boy?
Actually, you're thinking of Nick Carter, I say. Aaron Carter is his younger brother. My name is Carter Aaron, not Aaron Carter. I can tell she's already lost interest as she looks up at me beneath a set of gravity-defying false eyelashes. And who could blame her? I should not know the name of a Backstreet Boy's younger brother. Except I do,
because it's something I've had to explain at least a dozen times in my life. I push on, covertly glancing down at her list. There are a few names I recognize. Cameron from Literary, Sally from Foreign Rights, and a handful of others. "Can you tell me why I'm here?" I ask. "Fill out those forms," she says, nodding to the clipboard in my hand. "Then head to the second floor. Oh, and sign in, here." She hands me a badge with my name written across the front, and I reluctantly fill in the log. With a bland smile, she points me in the direction of the elevators. A guard swipes his badge to let me pass the security gate, and once inside the elevator, I press the button for the second floor. Pulling my phone back out, I send a quick message to Evie. "I think I'm in your building. Something weird is going on. Call me." After a moment, a vibrant elevator chime tells me I'm on the second floor, and when the doors open, I'm met by a smiling middle-aged woman and another set of matching security guards. "Okay." I'm instructed to have a seat in the lobby, and after peppering the woman with questions, I'm assured that someone will be arriving shortly to explain everything. The space is bright and expansive, with a number of plush chairs in small clusters that line a long bank of windows overlooking Beverly Boulevard. There are already a handful of people milling about. I recognize only a few. Nobody seems to have any idea what's going on. The lobby slowly fills and yet somehow manages to remain almost eerily quiet. Someone will walk in, invariably make some sort of squeak on the floor or some other noise that draws everyone's attention, and then nothing. It feels a lot like we're all 13-year-olds and waiting around to be called into the principal's office. "Carter..." I turn to see Kurt Elwood from Features walking toward me, hands in his hair and the usual grim expression on his face. "I thought I saw your name downstairs." I take in his appearance. "You okay, man?" He's a little on the green side, and there's a hint of perspiration dotting his upper lip. He pulls a roll of antacids from his pocket and pops one in his mouth, grimacing as he chews. "You know what this looks like to me?" I follow his gaze and survey the room. Everyone looks confused, but nobody seems on the verge of outright panic. "No. Like a company-wide layoff. Get us out of the building, away from our computers, where we can't access our files." "What?" I say, a bit taken aback by his suggestion, and look around the room again. "I've just assumed we're moving. We've been hiring like crazy. Layoffs have been as far from my mind as they could be." "You don't think they'd do something like that?" he asks. "Features aren't paying the bills anymore. People aren't going to the movies like they used to. Pirating is up. Profits are down. Not even you guys in TV are safe. P&D are packaging monsters." He stares at me. "What? You think they'd hand us all parting gifts and send us on our way? No, they separate us from everyone else to keep the drama to a minimum. Why do you think not everyone's here?" He pulls another Tums from the foil wrapping and looks at it before putting it between his lips and biting down. "The signs have been there for weeks." I'm torn between wanting to look away from the chalky pink antacid coloring his teeth and wanting to hear more. Every odd, unexplained event plays through my head, and I wonder if there could be some truth to his words. Emil Shepard has been less than thrilled with CTM for a while now. If he somehow got wind of this, he could move to me, and when I was let go, he'd have the option to transfer to someone else or leave altogether. Only a few boats rocked, and he's free. If Blake knew about this, it would explain his surprising non-reaction to everything with Emil so far. Kurt breaks into my thoughts. "Jesus Christ, I am 42 years old. Nobody wants a middle-aged, mediocre agent these days. They want sharks. They want agents as good-looking as the actors. I can't compete with that. Oh, my God," he groans. "I just bought a boat." "Okay, let's take a breath." I hope I sound calmer than I feel. "We don't even know what's happening yet. Let's not jump to any conclusions. Why would they bring us to P&D if they're laying us off? Why not just hold us in our own lobby?" I try to steer him away from the rest of the group, and he laughs, clapping me on the back of the shoulder. "Young, hopeful, naive Carter. Maybe you should take one of these," he says, turning my hand over and placing the last of the Tums in my palm. "You mark my words, we'll all be out of a job by lunch."
Chapter 7. Evie. With my phone to my ear, I cross the parking garage and search for my badge in the bottom of my purse. I'm running late, and this call has gone on longer than I expected, but if I can make everything work, it'll be worth it. So then let's talk seriously for a minute, I say into the line, badge finally in hand. I have no problem getting Tyler out to see you, but you've got to promise me it's to sit in front of a director. He's not back until November, and aside from all the work stuff he'll have scheduled, he'll want a little reconnecting time with his wife and kid. Tell me there's an actual meeting, and I'll get it on the books. I pass through the glass doors and head straight for the elevators. Okay, I say into the phone, swiping my badge at the security bars in the lobby. Take a look at your schedule. I'll have Jess follow up this afternoon. My assistant usually silently sits in on every call, but this morning she's oddly MIA. The security gate doesn't open, and I slide my card through the reader again. Nothing lights up, nothing dings. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Nev. With my phone tucked back into my purse, I walk across the lobby to the main security post, warily eyeing the makeshift table off to the side where two security guards stand stoically. I lean across the broad marble counter and look at the familiar guard sitting there. Hey, Jake, what's with the table over there? Jake looks up and back over my shoulder toward the elevators.
Miss Abby, is your card not working?
I hand it over, shaking my head. His wireframe glasses glint in the light as he glances down at something on his monitor before standing.
Your card's been locked. I need to send you up to the second floor.
Locked? And second floor? That's the P&D lobby and the conference center. No one really works there.
That's all I can really say, Miss Abby. But you aren't the only one. Let's get you upstairs.
He rounds the desk, signaling to another guard that he'll be right back.
This doesn't make any sense, I say, and pull out my phone again. Let me call Amelia. She'll know what's going on.
I believe Miss Baker is already here,
he says, and swipes his badge before following me to the elevators and pressing the button for the second floor.
Don't worry. I'm sure everything is going to be just fine.
Inside the elevator, I nearly throw my phone against the wall when I realize the ringer has been on silent all morning. There are messages from Daryl and Carter and one from Steph. A rare all-caps text from Jess sits at the top of the list. Evie, what is going on? My hands are shaking as I leave my text app without reading the rest and open my phone's browser to check Variety, knowing that whatever happens in this town, Variety or Twitter usually gets wind of it first. Of course, there's next to no reception inside the elevator, and my browser app is only beginning to load as the doors open with a loud ding. There's the sound of a voice echoing in the sudden silence, and I look down the wide hall to see an entire lobby of people turn to look at me. A woman near the front smiles in my direction.
Please, have a seat. We were just getting started.
The normally sparse lobby has been filled with chairs. About 2/3 of them are occupied. Mumbling a quiet apology, I tuck my phone away and speedwalk across the room to the first empty spot I see.
Good morning again,
the woman says, her smile bright, if a little forced. Her hair is long and red and hangs in thick waves to the middle of her back. I have no idea who she is, but my first thought is that she reminds me of a news anchor. She's perfectly groomed and looks exactly like the person you'd expect to tell you that everything is going to be all right, or whether you should run.
As I'm sure most of you have gathered, it has been quite a morning, she says. My name is Lisa, and I work in HR for the New York office of CTM.
Wait, she works for who? I'm about to raise my hand and ask what in the actual hell is going on when a few rows up, I spot a head turned to face me with a familiar set of green eyes. Carter. When I saw his name in my text scroll, I optimistically assumed he was seeing if I had time for a makeout session in the car over lunch. But he's here, in this hushed den of bewilderment. I try to put this all together, but my thoughts are like a record skipping uselessly upstairs. CTM's HR rep in the P&D lobby. Carter's eyes go wide to communicate his own confusion before he turns back toward the front. What the fuck is going on? I slump in my seat, staring at the back of his head before I look around at the rows of chairs in front of me and behind me, searching for more faces I recognize. Donald from accounting, Rose who works with me in features, and a handful of others. I see a mass of dark curls rising high above the other heads. Oh, thank all that is holy, Jess is here. Finally, I see Daryl in the back row. She throws her hands up as if to say, finally, and it's clear from her expression that she doesn't know what's going on either. She points to her phone just as the sound of footsteps draws both of our attention back to the front. Lisa hands a stack of files to a man now standing beside her. You're all either wondering what in the world is going on, or maybe you've heard already, but CTM and Price and Dickel have merged. She's saying something else, but it takes my brain a few seconds to process the words in order. When it does, the sound in my head is a little like tires screeching to a halt. CTM has merged with Price and Dickel. We are one agency. We are one agency with a huge amount of overlap. My stomach seems to have dissolved away, leaving a hollow space beneath my ribs. I look to Daryl, who seems to be reaching the same conclusion I have, and then around the room. A few heads nod, but not many. Most faces have gone ashen. And if you hadn't heard, she continues, making eye contact with a few of us, don't worry. It was only announced about half an hour ago. Half an hour ago? I think about all the strangeness in the office over the past few weeks, knowing that this type of thing doesn't just happen overnight. Those few people at the top, in the know, can strategize, position themselves. The big question is how long they had to prepare. The bigger question is who they are. Who knew? I think I might be sick. To be completely frank, we aren't sure what the merge looks like quite yet, Lisa says. Some of the dust needs to settle before we know what shape we'll take and how the new structure will work. But as the news will likely break widely soon, we wanted to gather you here to communicate information all together. A few people shift in their seats. A guy next to me is scrolling through his Twitter feed, presumably looking for information. As many of you know, Lisa continues, both P&D and CTM have corporate offices in New York as well as L.A. P&D is the acquiring company and will be bringing staff from both offices here to consolidate, as well as transferring some local staff to New York. My jaw drops open when she says this, and I barely hear what comes next. These are details you'll discuss with your direct managers in your department, but the bottom line, and the good news, is that if you're in this room, it's very likely that you still have a job at one office or the other. Very likely that you still have a job at one office or the other. I mean, that's something, at least, right? Most of the room has slumped somewhat in relief. I glance over at Carter. From what I can tell from the back, he's just sitting there, unmoving. Sorry, can you clarify? He asks in a garbled whisper. He has to clear his throat before adding, some of us will be transferred to New York and some will remain here. And when will this be decided? At this, Lisa turns to him and smiles like he's asked something as benign as whether the vending machines in the staff lounge will be stocked with Coke or Pepsi. Who stays and who is transferred is being left up to your individual departments. The way she says it, with an almost journalistic indifference, doesn't help the panic hijacking my motor system. I slip my fingers between my knees to keep them from shaking where anyone can see. It feels like a rug has just been pulled out beneath me. A murmur of voices, verging on angry, begins to build within the room. Honestly, I would love to be able to tell you all more, Lisa says above the fray. But as you can see, we're still getting details on this ourselves.
In my peripheral vision, I can see Carter's shoulders curl in, his head bow. He looks like I feel, like he wants to drop his head between his legs and look for something to throw up in. I lock eyes with Daryl and wonder if we're both thinking the same thing. We work for the acquiring company. We have some sort of advantage here, right? Tonight, I am going to stress eat a box of cookies like the world has never seen. We're dismissed shortly after, given a stack of papers, and told where to report for more information. It's likely everyone in this room had a packed schedule filled with actual work. I know I did, but that's all been changed into a schedule of determining whether we get to continue doing that actual work. Now we all wait while the people in charge try to figure out what the hell is going on. Carter is already speaking privately with Lisa. I move straight to Daryl. "Where's Amelia?" she says. And I realize, that's right. I haven't seen her. "I don't know." I search the room again. Amelia has worked in HR longer than either Daryl or I have been here. They wouldn't let her go. Would they? "Wait," I say, remembering. "On my way in, Jake said she was already here. I'm texting her." Daryl's fingers fly over her phone. "She wouldn't just not tell us." She pauses and I see exactly where her train of thought is going. "If she knew, she wouldn't have been able to tell us," I say, and Daryl's shoulders sag. "What a mess." She toys with the elastic at the end of her braid, eyes scanning the room. "I'll be right back. Eric's over there and I'm going to see if he knows anything. I doubt it, but his uncle is the damn boss, after all." She moves to leave and then stops, turning back to whisper, "Unless this means Brad is out?" "Oh my God, is that..." I look around us before leaning in. "Is that even possible?" I am unable to hide the tiny spark of hope that creeps into my voice. "I mean, why not? I wouldn't have guessed any of this in a million years. I'd say all bets are off. Back in a sec." As soon as she's gone, Carter pulls me aside. My pulse accelerates again. "What the hell is happening?" His hand lingers around my upper arm, grip tight, and for a couple of psychotic seconds, this entire thing seems oddly comical. "No idea," I say. "I'd been on a call all morning and then couldn't get into the elevators. As you saw from my less than subtle entrance, I just got here. My friend Amelia works in HR and we're trying to see if she knows anything, but I doubt she'd be able to say." "This is nuts. Merging means downsizing." "I know." I feel fairly secure in my position here at P&D, but in this moment, even with all the wins in my resume, the opening score to field day blares like a trumpet in the back of my mind. The air conditioning in the lobby seems to be set to ultra-mega-freezing, and I shiver, crossing my arms over my chest, trying to stay warm.
"I'd give you my jacket if we weren't suddenly in the weirdest dating coworker situation in the history of time," he says. And God, I hadn't even considered that.
Our phones vibrate at the same moment.
"Well, look at that. I have an email from Price and Dickel," he says.
"Same.
Is it too early for a drink?"
With a new keycard in hand, I head upstairs to my office only to be greeted by an eerie silence. Gone is the cacophony of printers and voices answering phones. Instead, calls are left to voicemail because what would the people answering them say, anyway? We've all been told to come back tomorrow for the transition. The CTM folks who weren't laid off were denied all access to their files and computers, but those of us from P&D with offices in the building came upstairs. What the hell else would we do? Despite Carter's very sound instincts, it really is way too early to start drinking. Not that anybody seems to be doing any actual work. Turns out P&D employees are locked out of our computers, too. Everyone is gathered in clumps at different desks, talking in hushed whispers and looking around on edge. And who can blame them?
Questions hang like thought bubbles suspended above heads, and the people who should be around to answer them are nowhere in sight. Who has a job today? Who will still have one tomorrow? I think back on some of the larger acquisitions I've read about over the years. The worst kind of merge is one where it happens quickly, before management can hammer out all the details and create a clear plan for combining departments and dealing with overlap. But here, I've been noticing oddities for a couple of weeks, which I hope means that it's been in the works for a while and there's a plan in place. I look around and there are a lot of long faces in the common areas. Most agencies are bottom-heavy, with tons of support staff, because so much of what gets done involves phone calls, emails, shuffling papers, and coordinating schedules. This new, combined agency is going to be doubly bottom-heavy, and the staff out here, barely out of their starving student days, knows it. I suppose they were all meant to go home for the day, but being here lends some sense of control, some hope they can influence decisions. Besides, who wants to be the one caught away from their desk when those kinds of decisions are being made? I head down the hall without speaking to anyone, torn between banging on Brad's door to get answers and crawling under my desk. Lucky for him, he's nowhere to be found. His office is dark, desk empty. In the blissful silence of my own office, I decide to keep the lights off, collapsing into my chair for the first time today. A part of me wonders if I can manage to hide here until it's time to go home, maybe even come in tomorrow to find this has all been one giant practical joke. Not likely. Through my interior windows, I see Daryl's blonde head as she weaves her way through the tables toward me, with Amelia, thank God, right behind. "Hiding out? Good thinking," Daryl says, peeking through the crack in the door before closing it behind them. She groans, dropping onto my small office sofa with one leg curled underneath her. "Eric was a bust. He doesn't know anything either. His greatest curiosity was whether the vending machine was still plugged in so he could get some chili cheese Fritos. Spoiler alert, he could." Amelia moves to sit at her side, closing her eyes as she settles back against the cushions. She looks exhausted. "You doing okay?" I ask her. Wincing, she admits, "I wish I had more to tell you guys. A few of us got phone calls at around 10 last night saying we needed to get in as early as possible this morning. I got in at 5. I didn't tell you guys because blah blah confidentiality." Kicking her shoes off, she stretches her legs out in front of her. "Anyway, I don't know a whole lot more than you. Apparently, P&D has been looking at CTM for some time, but the partners didn't want to sell. They must have changed their minds. I assume it was kept hush-hush because of what happened at Fairmount, when the top agents got wind and everyone jumped ship before the deal could be finalized." She lifts her chin to me. "Maybe you were onto something after all, Nancy Drew." "So if we're here, we still have jobs?" I ask, my head spinning. "Do they have any of that figured out yet?" She shakes her head. "I'm sure they do, but I haven't seen the department org charts yet. Tomorrow is when all the details are supposed to drop." Ugh, this is a nightmare. "Here's the Variety article," Daryl says, looking up from her iPad and tilting it so we can all see. In a surprising move Monday morning, top talent agency Price and Dickel, along with private equity backer William Trainer Group, acquired the competing agency Creative Talent and Media. The new company will retain the P&D name and, according to CEO Jared Helmsworth, will be a full-service agency. In his statement, Helmsworth said, "With offices in New York, Los Angeles, and London, this partnership will provide our clients access to the smartest and most creative minds in the business, with more opportunities to strike deals in digital content, TV, film, books, sports, licensing, and speaking engagements. The acquisition price remains undisclosed. It is likely that in the coming days, the restructured agency will be forced to lay off hundreds of supporting staff as well as agents. But when Variety reached out to a company spokesman for comment, we were told any speculation at this time would be premature. More to come." We sit back and marinate in our uneasy silence. I mean, it's not like there was really any new information in there, Daryl says finally. So why do I feel worse? Amelia closes her eyes.
This is exactly why my mother told me to marry Rich.
I don't think you have anything to worry about. You practically run your department. Turning to Daryl, I ask, how long do you have left on your contract?
1.5 years.
She gives a real smile for the first time in an hour. Let them buy me out. I could use some time off. What about you? Every agency does things a little differently. But at P&D, we're salaried with a bonus structure and contracted for a certain number of years. This could not have come at a worse time.
5 months, I say.
A lead ball of dread settles in my stomach. I can tell that my friends never quite perfected their game faces because their expressions make my nausea roll more intensely. I would be very easy and very inexpensive to lay off. Amelia quickly recovers.
Evie, you don't have anything to worry about. It's not the best timing, but you'll be fine. You kick ass here.
But Brad, I remind them. He'd be overjoyed to have a reason to toss another vagina overboard.
At least a vagina he doesn't get to play in, Daryl interjects.
I laugh, but it fades into a wary groan.
Or maybe he'll just lord this over my head for the next 5 months and not renew my contract.
I slip farther into my chair.
Oh, not to mention the whole Carter thing.
I rub my hand over my face. I finally meet a guy I like, a guy who's straight and doesn't live with his mom, and he was downstairs in that meeting.
What?
Daryl's eyes go wide. I nod. He was at CTM, remember? And it looks like he made the first cut. He works with us now. Amelia is staring at me in amused shock, but Daryl quickly recovers.
Okay, first of all, let's all breathe.
Breathe.
Second, the Carter thing will work itself out. Let's see.
Daryl stops, and I know exactly what she was going to say. Let's see if you even have a job tomorrow to worry about.
Let's see how everything plays out. She finishes instead. And third, we don't even know whether Brad still works here. Nobody knows where he is. Kylie is MIA too. If he's not here, your agency record, minus a few tiny bumps along the way, stands on its own. Don't count yourself out yet. I have a good feeling about this.
God, please let her be right. I can only assume Carter likewise polished off a bottle of wine by himself last night, and that's why I didn't hear from him. At least, that's what I keep telling myself. Suffice it to say, I am not the best version of Evie on Tuesday morning. My mom, who reads Variety and Deadline religiously, called about 7,000 times yesterday. I finally answer her call when I'm picking up my morning coffee at Verve, after maybe 2 hours of restless sleep.
Evie, baby, she says. I'm on my way over. Mom, no, I'm not home right now.
I'll meet you. Tell me where.
I sigh, sitting down at a small table in the corner. I don't even need to ask what she's thinking to know exactly how her mind works.
I don't want you to come do my hair.
My mom has done hair in this town for almost 35 years, her crowning achievement being the episodes of Dynasty in 1984 for which she was personally responsible for Joan Collins's wigs. According to my mom, there is no problem a good blowout can't solve.
It will make you feel better, she says.
And I can hear the familiar theme song to Good Morning America playing in the background. To my mom, nothing fixes a bad day faster than fresh hair, a scalp massage, and the confidence of stiff hairspray.
I could give you a little trim. Your hair's gotten so long, and you know it has a tendency to look a little raggedy at the ends.
It's going to be fine. I don't need a haircut. Cut Dad's hair. I love you. I've got to get into work.
Even if I have no idea what that work might entail. My phone rings again as I walk out of Verve, coffee in hand. I have to look twice for confirmation when I see the name illuminated on the screen. Carter.
Hello?
Hey,
he says.
and if I'm not mistaken, he too is mildly hungover and in desperate need of caffeine.
How are you?
I want to laugh at his tone. It sounds a little like I feel, calm, layered over a hurricane.
I'm good. A little tired.
Tell me about it, he says, voice rough.
I wanted to give you a heads up that I'll be at P&D this morning. I guess everything's already been moved over, the computers, the files. Apparently they did it all in the middle of the night after informing us of the merge and informing the first cut of the cuts.
Wow, that sounds harsh.
Anyway, he says, I just wanted to let you know. I realize this is weird, to say the least.
My heart gives a little jolt in my chest. Carter is such a nice guy. It makes all of this even more twisty.
Well, at least I'll get to see you today, then, I tell him.
How's everyone handling it on your end? Steph said the crew at Alterman went into panic mode, thinking they'd get sucked into this.
I talked to Michael Christopher last night and joked that I might need to move into his guest room if my position gets cut, he says.
And I want to reach through the phone and hug him. P&D is pretty small and notoriously cutthroat.
You hear anything on your end?
Not really. There was a company-wide email last night, but it was basically a rehash of what we already knew. He sighs.
That's what I figured.
What about you? You doing okay?
I've been better.
He lets out a tight laugh.
I mean, I'm assuming I still have a job. Unlike my assistant, which is why she wasn't at the meeting yesterday.
Oh my God, Carter, I'm sorry.
Thanks,
he says.
Honestly, Becca was amazing. I'd be lost without her on a normal day. I have no idea how I'll navigate through all this.
I feel a little sick for him, knowing how I'd feel if I lost Jess, especially right now.
On a brighter note,
he adds,
looks like I'll finally be meeting the illustrious Brad Kingman.
A metaphorical trapdoor has just opened under my feet. I'm sorry, what did you say?
Brad Kingman.
He heads up my department. Features, not TV literary.
I know, Carter says,
and I can hear the shrug in his voice.
But that's what it said when they told me where to go this morning. My meeting is with Brad.
Chapter 8. Evie. At 5 to 10, my desk phone rings. I keep my eyes on the monitor in front of me and exhale in relief when, after a second ring, it goes silent. Good, I think, finishing an email. I don't want to talk to anyone today anyway. There's a knock less than a minute later, and I look up to see Jess standing in the doorway. She nods toward the unanswered phone. Despite the dark window, she motions to the pane of glass next to my door. I knew you were in here. I'm sorry, I tell her guiltily. Would you think less of me if I told you I was scared? She laughs as she steps inside, closing the door behind her. Now that we have computer access, most people are on LinkedIn or Googling how to survive a merger. I press send before looking back up. Though I don't know what we're all hiding for. Nobody's even seen Brad, and yesterday was such a confusing shit show, I should feel confident that today can't top it. Jess clears her throat, and I narrow my eyes at her, wary. What? Well, the reason I called... She winces a little. The gold studs in her ears twinkle back at me beneath the fluorescent lights as she grips the back of the chair she's leaning on. He's here. When you didn't answer, he called me. He wants to see you. Brad? Brad. I slump in my chair. Well, fudge. He's been calling people in all morning, and it looks like it's your turn. Or, you know, up to bat, as he would say. I groan. So he is staying. Everyone looks up as I walk past on my way to Brad's office. If he's been calling people in all morning, who knows what they've seen? Relief, tantrums, tears, anything is possible. I rarely question my appearance anymore. a gift that seems to have arrived with the transition into my 30s. But with all eyes on me, I feel like an awkward model on a catwalk. I really should have worn my padded bra. In my peripheral vision, a few heads turn, their attention lingering on something at the other end of the hall. I follow their gaze. Carter. His suit is charcoal gray and looks like it was made for him by magical tailor elves. It hugs his shoulders, tapers at his waist, frames his body perfectly. I tug at the hem of my shift dress, suddenly feeling frumpy. His long legs close the distance between us in just a few strides.
Hey.
I try to keep my gaze in the safe zone, on his tie. It's blue with tiny green flecks, and I already know that if I look up, I'll see the way it brings out the color in his eyes. Yep, it does. Hi. I am hyper aware of all eyes on us. I mean, why wouldn't they be watching this train wreck? I would. Not that they know I had his penis in my hand a few days ago, and now we apparently work together, but it's probably written all over my face. Or maybe they aren't watching because of me at all. Maybe they're watching us because Carter is a new, gorgeous guy in the department. I feel an odd mix of possessiveness and unease. I'm just on my way to Brad's office. I'm eager to put some space between us and the office full of onlookers. How did it go with you?
I don't know yet, he says. Our 8 a.m. was delayed. I'm on my way there now. Kylie was just taking me.
And it's only now that I notice Brad's assistant, Kylie, standing a few paces away, nonchalantly checking out Carter's ass. When she catches my eye, she steps closer. Carter smiles down at her. She smiles back, a hint of pink blooming on her neck and cheeks. A direct hit. An eerie sense of foreboding prods at my brain. Kylie clears her throat and walks ahead of us, stopping outside the door to Brad's corner office.
You can go on in.
She gives Carter a smile that lingers just past too long and verges on weird. Or maybe it's only weird because I'm here, staring like she's committing some grave offense by looking at him.
He's expecting you both.
I'm sorry, Kylie, I say. Did you say he's expecting us both? As in, together?
That's right.
Do you know why? My brain cycles back to the image of my hands in Carter's pants, his cum on my... I shake my head. Brad would have no way of knowing any of that, but it's the only connection I can make.
Nope.
She looks at each of us in turn.
Is there a problem?
No problem at all.
Carter motions for me to lead the way.
Thanks, Kylie.
Anytime.
She offers him an encouraging thumbs up before whispering,
You'll do great.
You have got to be kidding me. With an awkward cough, Carter glances down to the floor as I pass, and we both step into Brad's office. Brad Kingman has that air about him. You know the one, where it's clear he thinks he's a little better, a lot smarter, and leagues more connected in this town than you are. He also does that thing that all the best intimidating people do, where he stares directly at you when he's speaking. When you talk, if you're important enough for him to actually listen, he'll make you feel like the most fascinating person in the world. But be ready. If you call, you'd better know what you want to say. If you come to his office, get it out, and quickly. He doesn't do polite small talk and doesn't schmooze. But when Carter steps through the door, it's like a Brad Kingman I've never seen before stands to greet him.
Carter,
he says, grinning widely. He rounds the desk, reaching out to offer a hand.
It's good to meet you, son.
Son. Carter's posture tweaks initially as he's taken aback, but he recovers quickly.
It's good to meet you, too,
he says, shoulders straight. Chin up and grip strong as he shakes Brad's proffered hand. He looks calm. Good. He's done his homework. Brad claps him on the back and motions for him to take a seat before turning his attention to me.
Evie, it's been quite a madhouse around here, hasn't it?
He pulls out a chair for me and I give him a smile in return.
It sure has.
Circling back around his expansive walnut desk, Brad takes a moment to look at each of us in turn.
Have you met?
I glance at Carter, offering a wan smile.
Yeah, we know each other.
See, this is what I'm talking about, Brad says. This is a team.
Carter, I want you to know that Evie here has become my right-hand kid. Any questions you have, anything you need, Evie is the girl to talk to. Understand?
I feel my cheeks warm under the simultaneous compliment and condescension of right-hand kid and the girl to talk to.
Absolutely,
Carter says, glancing at me a little uneasily.
She's been nothing but helpful so far.
Brad wraps the knuckles of one hand against the desk and leans back in his chair.
That's good to hear. Now, if I had to guess what's cycling through your heads this morning, I suspect there's a bit of confusion about what's going on. Am I right?
Pretty much,
Carter says with a small laugh.
I get that. I do get that.
Brad straightens, hands folded in front of him.
Evie here will tell you that I am all about playing as a team, Carter. And here at Price and Dickel, we are only as strong as our weakest player. Isn't that right, Evie?
I say through clenched teeth.
That's right, Brad.
Which means we need every player to be able to knock it out of the park. I brought the two of you in here together for a couple reasons. The first is that between the three of us, I think you two are the best we've got. I've heard a lot about you, Carter. It's why I snagged you from TV Lit. You belong in features. You two can bring our department back into the game.
He pulls two files from the bottom of a stack and opens the first.
You started as a finance clerk at a boutique agency in New York?
He asks, and Carter nods.
And what did you learn from that?
Carter shifts in his seat, glancing at me before returning his attention to Brad. I didn't know this.
Obviously, there's going to be quite a bit I don't know, so this is a first. Getting to know a potential boyfriend through a thinly veiled grilling session in our boss's office.
Well, of course I heard a lot of gossip,
Carter admits, smiling easily.
There are agents who act like anyone not involved in a negotiation isn't really there. Because of that, I overheard conversations I probably shouldn't have.
To my own ear, it sounds like he's underselling for some reason, still keeping his cards close. If I'm right, Brad knows it, too.
That's it?
Brad asks. Carter hesitates for a moment.
It's a good way to learn how people handle pressure, observing it from the outside. You learn to catalog everyone's reaction, anticipate who will do what when the shit hits the fan.
Brad smiles, and because I know Brad, I can tell he's amused by Carter's casual swearing. By contrast, he would wince and chastise me for doing the same. I feel queasy. I knew Carter was charming, but secretly hoped it had something to do with my wanting to bang him. Apparently not, because he's playing Brad perfectly, too.
Start at the bottom and take what you learn to the top,
Brad says, nodding. Carter grins and charisma seeps into the room.
Something like that.
Brad scribbles down a couple of notes and turns to me.
Now, Evie here, she could talk a grenade out of exploding. That's a skill you want to learn, Carter. Lots of people can be decent agents, but it takes a special one to spot talent and an even better one to keep it. There's been a stumble or two,
he pauses meaningfully,
but for the most part, she's proven she belongs with the big boys. Hell, she's trained some of the best agents in this town.
I bite my tongue. It's unlike Brad to hand out praise so baldly, and I brace myself, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Now, like I said, I think you two are the best we have, but I'll be honest. I don't know if we can keep you both.
What?
We both say in unison. Brad holds up his hands, motioning for us to let him finish.
Your compensation is comparable, which is why I have you both in here, and I don't know if P&D will have the room to renew both contracts, at least not here in L.A.
We stare ahead, stunned. I can feel my face going red, my stomach twisting into knots. I'm 5 years older than Carter and have been doing this job in one form or another since I was 19.
Judging from what I've seen, Carter is probably a great agent, but he's only lived in L.A. for 2 years and is new to features. Like, today new. In what universe is our compensation comparable? Because he's a man? Who knew a penis was worth so much? Brad, Carter begins, expression grim. I clench my fists at my sides and force myself to take a deep breath.
It's not definite that one of you will be shifted over, Brad says. But I'll be honest, it's likely. We're all going to have to do the work and see what fits best for the new combined features team.
I don't understand, I say. P&D is one of the most successful agencies in the country. How can it not keep us both? I glance to Carter and back again. Brad, look at my numbers. I outperform.
Minus your little speed bump with field day,
he says with a superior nod, and I straighten in my chair. Fuck him for bringing that up right now.
Listen, kiddo, the simple fact is that the movie business is down. Expenses are up. Cuts are made in this type of situation, and that's just the way it is. You two aren't the only ones this is affecting.
I glance at Carter. He's staring directly at Brad.
When you said not here in L.A., Carter begins carefully, are you saying that if one of our contracts isn't renewed, there's a chance that individual would be offered a position in New York?
Brad nods.
For sure, there's a position in L.A., and a spot in New York is always a possibility. Ideally, there would be two positions here, but it's too early to speculate on that. On any of it, really.
We both sit there, silent. I stare at a glossy whorl of walnut that stands out in the section of wood grain just in front of me. It's the size of my fist, but takes up only the smallest fraction of the surface of Brad's enormous executive desk. I wish I could press my finger to it, swirl, and flush this entire exchange down the toilet.
What I want both of you to do for the short term, Brad says, pulling my eyes back to his face, is to put this situation out of your heads. You each have a contract that P&D will see through, and then we'll examine it again. Evie, you've got 5 months left on your current contract. Carter, you're due to re-sign in 6. At the time of renewal, it's possible there will only be room for one. But you're not competing. Not exactly.
The words "not exactly" fall like bricks dropped from 20 feet up.
Meet with some of the agents, the support staff, on both sides, Brad continues with practiced obliviousness. Talk to the team we have here visiting from New York. Get a sense for how your lists are going to react and how you can retain them. We'll be talking about that a little later in the week.
He turns to me.
Evie, I don't think retentions will be as big of an issue for you since your clients were already P&D. So what I would love is for you to show Carter around. Show him how we do things. Maybe introduce him to some of your colleagues and contacts.
I feel sick. Just like with John Feynman, Brad is having me pass along some of my hard-earned connections to a coworker. But not just any coworker, to Carter, my new, almost, boyfriend, with whom I'm not exactly competing for a job.
Of course, I say, because what else can I do? Carter, Brad says, turning. You have enough charisma to take over this entire town, and I think you'll do it. Listen to Evie. Learn the ropes. She knows what she's talking about.
He looks between us.
At least for the time being,
he says, leaning back in his chair again.
I think you will make an amazing team. Try to see it that way.
He smiles, leans forward with his hands steepled beneath his chin, and gives us the patented icy blue stare. Brad Kingman has excused us. Out in the hallway, Carter and I each study the floor, the wall, the table desks in the distance. The number of things we could say about the situation seems infinite. But, oddly, as much as I've enjoyed his company and his kisses and his penis, Carter is the last person I want to talk to about this right now. I can tell he's tense. I can tell we're both tense.
but I need to process a little bit in my own head before I help him process it, too. He lets out a quiet whistle. This is unreal.
I agree. I have to pull my eyes away from the tension in his jaw.
When I heard we'd merged, my biggest fear was just that it would be hard to work with my new girlfriend.
My heart swoops low in my chest when he says this.
But now it's like...
He shakes his head, running a hand through his thick hair.
I need this job. I moved here for this job.
My entire life is here, I remind him. I've worked for P&D for 5 years. I realize this situation really sucks for you, but I've built connections here. I've built a career here.
You have enough charisma to take over this entire town, and I think you'll do it.
Brad's words to Carter bounce around the inside of my skull, and I squeeze my hands into fists at my sides. Brad wants Carter to take over the entire town. Where exactly does that leave me?
Carter glances over to me, and for a flash I can see annoyance in his green eyes, but he quickly tucks it away. This is probably not the time to talk about it.
He closes his eyes, taking a couple of deep breaths.
Look, this is the worst thing that could have happened between us, and I realize that.
He puts a warm hand on my forearm.
But we're going to figure it out. Don't worry.
For some reason, his reassurance bothers me even more. It's true, this isn't a great situation for either of us, but I don't need him to patronize me and tell me that everything will be okay when he knows exactly as much as I do. And I especially don't need him to try to reassure me after he's just told me how much he needs to be the one to keep his job. We drift apart without more conversation, moving in opposite directions away from Brad's office. I head to get a drink of water from the break room while Carter walks toward the restrooms. I know I should eat the Luna bar I put in my purse this morning, but my stomach seems to have closed up shop for the day. In order to help with the transition, P&D brought in a few team members from New York. And just like Brad suggested, early that afternoon I have a one-on-one with a senior agent I've met on several occasions, a woman I deeply admire. Her name is Joanne Sims, and she's a shark. She started in features and has moved over to the television side, but she knows everyone. At first blush, she's the sweetest human you could possibly meet, but in negotiations, the gloves come off. She's my Kathy Bates in Fried Green Tomatoes. If you're in her parking spot, she will ram her car into your car without a second thought. And then maybe set it on fire. Her temporary office is in the corner and has a beautiful view of downtown and the mountains beyond. This office was recently occupied by Tom Hetchum, head of legal at P&D. Tom is no longer with us. Joanne beckons me in, and while she finishes up a call, I stand near the window, trying to calm my racing heart. I love the view of L.A. from this side of the building. It reminds me how many people there are here, how many opportunities, how much space there is for everyone in the sprawling mass of buildings. I'm not an optimist, but I'm not exactly a pessimist either. I'm a wait-and-see-when-you-have-more-info-ist. My opinions spend 90% of their time in a holding pattern before swooping in like a hawk. And right now, my opinions need Joanne to get off the phone and tell me this is all bullshit and everything will be fine. In the end, she doesn't tell me that. But there's a hopeful vibe to the meeting, anyway. Joanne is hilarious. She loves her job, she loves what she does, and she's a woman who never lets the old boys' game get in her way. She is exactly what I want to be. We talk about her list, about the kind of list I have and where I'd like to see it go. We talk about the clients I'll likely inherit from the agents who were let go and how to manage my current client's panic, along with the panic of those actors passed off to someone new. We have a conversation that feels a lot like long-term planning, and although I won't get to work with Joanne much because she's in New York and in television, just knowing she'll be around for a while is reassuring. At the end of the meeting, I feel a million times better about my place here, and I generally feel like Carter and I can find a way to make this work. At the very least, I feel confident that I'm needed, and that upper management at P&D knows that. The hallways are quiet as I leave Joanne's office, and I have a moment of peace to myself to sit and think about this morning. I saw Carter heading into John Feynman's office earlier, and instinctively I want to wait for him. I feel so much better after talking to Joanne, and I want to infuse a conversation with Carter with some of that hopefulness. But when I see him emerge, I immediately sense his meeting did not go as well. His position is admittedly more precarious than mine, and I do really like him. I don't want him moving to New York any more than I want to move there myself. "How did it go with John?" I ask. He smiles a little dryly.
I think that was the most talking I've ever done in a one-on-one meeting before.
I laugh. John is not known for his conversation skills. I sat next to him at a company Christmas dinner, and let's just say it's amazing he does any deals. He's not known for being very sociable. I feel a little like I'm marking my territory here, emphasizing my familiarity with people he's only just meeting. I know I should pull back and be more of a team player. Carter is the new guy, after all. So I go for encouragement. I'm sure you were great. I bet everyone loves you. Carter studies me for a few breaths, and I get the distinct impression that he knows exactly what I'm doing.
It looks like things went well with Joanne.
I nod, smiling. When are you meeting with her?
Later this week.
Do you want to grab some lunch? I ask. I could fill you in on what's what here, who's sleeping with who, and where the good coffee is hidden. He looks away, unsmiling, as he squints at a point in the distance down the hall.
I think I'm just going to grab a sandwich and catch up on all the emails I need to deal with, he says. I've got a million things to handle right now. Maybe some other time?
I know people. I can easily spot the careful stepping back. Okay. I watch as he pinches the bridge of his nose, and then he looks up and gives me a pained smile.
I'll see you later.
He turns to head down the hall, and his posture immediately changes. His shoulders are straight, and his ass looks amazing in his dark dress pants. Heads turn. A few interns lean in and discuss him when he's walked past, their expressions eager, admiring. It's as if the star quarterback has just strolled down the hall. My high from my meeting with Joanne deflates as I see exactly what they see. Confidence, charisma, competition. Chapter 9. Evie.
How can you not like Brussels sprouts? Amelia asks Daryl, holding the fork in front of our friend's scrunched-up face.
We're doing an emergency happy hour, with food instead of drinks. I am not a consistent stress drinker, but I am a fantastic stress eater. Daryl gently pushes away her hand.
Because they taste like ass in my mouth?
I'm up for ass in my mouth, I say. I'll take her share.
Amelia studies me for a moment before dropping them onto my plate.
Careful who you say that to.
Speaking of, we should have invited Carter, Daryl says. He's cute, and probably freaking out just as much as we are right now.
Daryl's department was hit a little differently than was Features. They still have cuts, but it's far cheaper to keep Daryl than to buy her out. She's safe for at least another year. I shake my head, quickly swallowing an enormous bite.
He didn't want to.
So far, I've only given them the bullet points. Hiding in my office, worrying I was going to be fired, meeting with Brad, thinking I might not be fired. Surprise, there might only be a job here for one of you. And by one of you, we mean you or this new guy you want to bang.
Didn't you, you know?
Daryl makes a crude sexual hand gesture, adding,
like, only a few nights ago?
Use your big girl words, Daryl, Amelia says.
Third base, I confirm. And it was a holy experience. Orgasmus maximus. My bedspread and I were hoping for a repeat.
So how is it going to play out? Amelia asks. You can't work together and sleep together?
Or maybe you won't work together at all and you can still sleep together, Daryl counters. Great, except for that part about one of us being an unemployed hobo. Homelessness tends to be a real mood killer. I pop a pita chip in my mouth and chew.